This is checkpoint number 3. The first barn on the left has an interesting feature. See the design cut in the wood under the roof line?
See that? See the diamond cross? Now, in the old world, this was called an Eulenloch, or owl hole. And farmers would put these on their barns so that barn owls could fly through them and nest up there and fight the rodents. But in this country, they became quite decorative, and rather than being functional, they were decorative, and they were indicative, I think, of the crews of carpenters who built these barns. And they were very often masons. And the half moon, the diamond, you know, what is called a diamond cross, which this one is very typical in Pennsylvania and into Ontario in Canada. And you don't see it very often here. It's rather difficult to cut. But in the eastern part of Ohio, as you go westward, these things totally disappear. This is very traditional stuff. You find a lot of them in southeastern Ohio.
But this part of Athens County has another legacy too, coal. Sharpsburg and Lathrop were on the eastern edge of the Hocking Valley coal field, the first coal field in the state. Ivan Tribe, professor of history at Rio Grande, has studied the development of the Hocking Valley coal fields and written 2 books on the topic.
It was a major industrial region as a mining area for better than 50 years because agriculture has never been really strong in this part of Ohio, so it was the first real form of major industrialization to hit. We're talking about people that went from almost a pioneer farming type of lifestyle to an industrialized region within just a few years, and mining was the major reason for that.
One of the largest mining operations was here along Route 550 in a small mining town called Lathrop.
I think they employed about 100 men when they were in full capacity. It employed men from this part of Athens County and the southern part of Morgan County, Chester Hill. And it was, they were the big salaries, wages in the community.
There's always a greater demand for coal in the winter because people primarily also used coal to heat their homes after it became available. Miners would tend to only work part-time, you know, you would work 3 days a week or 2 days a week. And of course there was no unemployment insurance in those days.
There were other, smaller coal mines in the area too. Many were coal miners, only part-time. Dorothy Sargeni.
My father used to work, and I think he only worked in the winter times because he had to farm in the summertime and raise our food.
Dorothy grew up south of Amesville in a town called Broadwell. Her father worked as a coal miner in Sugar Creek in the winter. He would board there all week and come home to her mother and 9 children on the weekends. But in the 1930s, the Depression shut down most of the mining in the region. The people got by as best they could.
And in the summertime, we kids would all go berry picking for blackberries, and my mother would can about 200 quarts of berries. And then at summertime, before school, she'd hire somebody to take her to Athens to buy our shoes for school. So in the spring, when the whippoorwills hollered, we could go barefooted, and we went barefooted until it was cold. Frost came.
Although most people went to Athens at least once or twice a year to go shopping for necessities, most of the routine shopping was done here in Amesville. Longtime residents Bob Henry and Bill Clark.
Yeah, we had a hardware store. We had a mill that ground up feed for animals, you know, for cattle feed. They had a pool room. They had a creamery. They had a planing mill.
And the railroad. And the lumber yard. Then up the street was a hardware store. Then we went up to the bank. And across from the bank was a grocery store. And on down on the far side of Main Street, a brick building, was another grocery store. Oh, in between time, there's another grocery store with a cabinet shop upstairs. And then we get down on the corner of Trimble Road, and it's 550. And the corner building there was a grocery store. Across the street from that was the hotel. And back across on this side of the filling station, that was at one time a general store, a big general store. Called, it was owned by a pair of two brothers. They were called the Painter Sisters. They were kind of finicky, but they were brothers, but they called them the Painter Sisters.
An even earlier general store was the Brown and Dickey General Store. It operated in the 1860s. Then the farmers would trade their grain, wool, bacon, or tobacco for what goods they needed. It was the merchant's job to get those goods to market. Will Brown wrote about his father's ventures.
In the fall, father and his partner used to go into the tall timber about a mile from the store, cut down logs, and have the carpenters build them in Federal Creek, a scow or flatboat. This they stored with grain, bacon, wool, tobacco, dried fruit, and such. It was a thrilling thing to see the boat swing off down the creek, knowing it would be carried into the Hocking, then the Ohio, and finally the channel of the Mississippi River.
By using the creeks and rivers as their highways, Amesville farmers traded with ports along the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. The frontier was passing. As they became more prosperous, farmers built finer homes, like this red brick eye house. Roads, too, became increasingly important as communities grew. As one of the intercounty highways that connected county seats of government, Route 550 was one of the better roads in the area.
I'm John Dower. Well, I know mainly stories my father told me. He graduated from Ohio State as a civil engineer in 1923, and there weren't many engineers, highway engineers, in those days. So, and he came down here, and so in the mid-20s, one of the first things they did was built that road. Of course, the road was built at that time with slip scrapers pulled by mules, which is why, this is another thought here, I'm going to ramble, but most roads that just sort of wander around like that and have a lot of hills and curves were never really built or designed. They widened out where the guy walked through, where the horse came through, and made it wide enough for a wagon, and like 690 right next door to that.
Roads were terrible. Just no comparison. Even this road out here was just a gravel road, even back that part back. And this is one of the main highways, this Route 550, between here and Chillicothe, because it was, they called it a star route. I don't know why, but that's what they called it.
My dad said, that, of course, they had to live out there, and they were living in a boarding house up at the top of Sharpsburg Hill someplace, and across the road where the mules were being kept. So you can imagine a bunch of mules, what that yard looked like. And they'd eat out on the porch across the way, and all the mule skinners and the state inspectors would be out there eating together. And my dad said you could tell the state inspectors from the mule skinners because the state inspectors would all wait to get a piece of bread until a mule skinner took one. And then, of course, there'd be a clean one, and the flies hadn't been on yet. And the state guys would all dive in real quick and get a piece of bread before the flies landed again.
On the hill ahead is Windy Hills. Originally settled in 1780 by the Donaldson family, the house and grounds were remodeled and developed in the early part of this century by Jenny Donaldson Beasley and her husband Fred Beasley.
Fred had started out with a small garage in Amesville. Then he moved to Athens and big business. As he summed it up at a 1947 banquet in his honor, "I started out on horseback over in Amesville to sell automobiles. Before that, I'd been selling buggies, but found out that you could make $40 on every car you sold, which beat the $10 I got for selling buggies."
By 1947, he owned the largest number of independent Ford dealerships in the world, 19 in all. The mechanical age had arrived.
Now, my grandfather, years ago, in 1927, he made enough money to buy him a new Chevrolet sports roadster, I think they call it. The little rag top, and it cost $700. I can remember that so plainly because I rode in it, and he mentioned different times.
During the late 1920s and early 30s, thousands of people, like Oliver Riley's grandfather, changed their means of transportation from horses to cars.
But $700 in those years is a lot of money. But he managed to do it.
The change to motor vehicles meant another change as well. In order to drive cars, the roads had to be improved.
This road was built and designed by the early engineers, but the earth-moving equipment was not so that they could do much about hills, and so they had to curve around obstacles and hills and things, and that's why, like that out of Sharpsburg, the hill is so big.
Well, the road was built always at the break of the slope because flooding was a real serious problem. And so you pushed your road up against the break of the slope, which creates another interesting thing in Ohio, and that is the division of the farmstead. You have land on this side, and the farm is usually on that side. And very often you come up by a sign, you know, and it says cows crossing or animals crossing because you have that separation of the property. The contemporary roads then shift away toward the flat land, right? Because now you have the technology to build a dike, you know. And that creates problems because it impounds water on either side, so you get swampy, marshy areas and the fields, you know. But you get that movement away from that original area, right? Because it straightens things out for fast automobile travel. So actually there's sort of a gradation, you know, that you can very often observe between the very earliest roads that were right next against the break of the slope into flatter and flatter land, straightening them out. Finally, you end up with the interstates.
Not here. Here, the roadbed remains pretty much where it was in the early 1900s. But the road quality has improved considerably. Oliver Riley grew up just over the hill in a small mining town called Sugar Creek. His father and grandfather worked in the mines. But by the 1920s, the mines were closing down, so the people turned to other industries for income.
Oh, yeah, it was quite a booming thing, making your own home brew. That's the way they made a lot of money. The sheriff wouldn't bother out through here at all because he knew that was a livelihood of the people other than mining.
Coal mining communities such as Sugar Creek tended to be close-knit. Being a one-industry town, the people had much in common.
We were from a pretty poor family. We had what we needed to eat and clothes, but our clothes didn't look like some of the other ones. Kids make fun of us, and me, I always had some fight. At the time that I went to school up here in the early 30s, late 20s, early 30s. Most of the people in this vicinity close to the school was Hungarians, foreigners, Hungarians and Assyrians, and people that came here to work in the mines, came here, some of them even from the old country, they call it. But I went to school, most of the people I went to school, kids I went to school with was Hungarians. A lot of others.
My name is Susan South, born and raised on Sugar Creek. It's a coal mine town. My father was a coal miner. My husband was a coal miner. And in those days, in Depression days, we had a hard time getting along. My father, when he worked in coal mine, he'd worked so long, and then we'd have to use the money that my mother had saved up. I was the only child, but we were. It was poor times. It was Depression times.
Yes, they were. They were pretty closely knitted as a family. back then, they did more of that. There was more visiting among people.
We'd have parties in between when we got older.
In homes. On Saturday night, people would take turns inviting people in to dance, and they'd hire some musicians, a fiddle player and a guitar, backup player or something. And if we got a dollar and a half apiece at night, we were rich. We were what? Of course, that's years ago I'm talking about now. Yes, I used to do a lot of that. We had three or four company stores, and that's where the miners went to get their commodities or food and kerosene for their lamps. Back then, there wasn't this thing called electricity. A huge two-story building, and they had everything, stovepipe, pokers, and just about everything, coal buckets and everything like that. They paid miners in cash, but they would run a bill. They would run like a month at a time or whatever the case. I think monthly is what they paid. Back then, you could get a pound of bologna for 10 cents. I do remember my dad talking about that, and I was pretty small, but I can remember it. But they had flour. And you didn't buy 5 pound of flour. You bought 25 pound. That's the way it came. And that's, I'm speaking now when I was a child, when I was small. And sugar, the same way. The sugar usually came 25-pound bag. And potatoes, if you didn't raise your own, which we did, you'd probably 100-pound sack of potatoes. And that's the way it was in it.
Southeastern Ohio has been one of those regions of Ohio which has passed through a lot of hardship economically, right? The early settlers came in here with visions of developing this area according to what they saw was their way of life, farming. Well, they found out it was pretty tough. And people came and looked at the fantastic trees that we had on the land and said, why not the trees, right? So then lumbering becomes significant and important. And once we start looking at the trees, people started also finding, of course, some of the things which were underneath. And as we dug deeper and deeper into the ground, we found coal, right? And then, of course, that is pretty much the story. Once we found the coal, then we went after the coal, right? And but as any exploitive or resource-oriented area, of course, tells us, it's an up-and-down sort of situation, boom and bust, right? So again, but that lens, that provides some fascinating sort of stories about our region.
Soundtracks was written and produced by Sandra Slight Brennan. The announcers are Gay Dalzell and Doug Partouche. The music is by Rusty Smith, Jed Foley, Ed Newman, and Zeke Hutchinson. This program was made possible, in part, by the Ohio Joint Program in the Arts and Humanities. For more information on Soundtracks and other audio tours, go to our website, www.trilliummedia.org.